Hello and welcome back to the Bentley Quarry Museum podcast. My name is Alexander and I'm here as your host for this episode. So today I'm very excited to be in conversation with Jim B and Paul Smith, who are going to talk to us about their time working at RAF Bentley Quarry and the fond memories they have of the top secret bunker. So would you both like to introduce yourselves today, including your role at RAF Bentley Quarry and your years of service there?
I'll go first, Paul. I was very fortunate. I did three tours at Bentley Quarry, which kind of made the place my spiritual home in the RAF. First tour was at a place called the Systems Development Centre, which was an interesting place, but I'll talk a bit more about that later. Then a short tour abroad brought me back to Bentley Quarry, back to the Systems Development Centre, but then I moved across to Headquarters Number 11 Group in the Standby Air Defence Operations Centre on promotion. And then a short stint away in Scotland to RAF Buchan. I was back again, this time as the senior NCO in charge of the exercise design team, which involved quite a lot of work down in the bunker, as we discussed previously.
Okay, and so I joined Bentley May 1988. First of all, went to the Systems Development Centre and went into a role where they weren't quite ready for me. So after, I think, about 3 months, I moved to Headquarters 11 Group. So I got posted from the SEC to about 10 yards down the road. And I was at the Air Staff Registry at 11 Group, and I left, I think it's about October 1990, late 90, I know that.
Okay, great. So thinking about you mentioning the systems development, can you tell me more about that? What did this involve?
The Systems Development Centre is, it was an interesting place. I think you either loved it or hated it. I've several friends who absolutely really didn't like working there. It was an interesting place. It was a new build. It was probably the last thing they built at Bentley before they knocked everything down. And when they brought in the Air Defence Ground Environment Kit, the new IUCAG system, that basically this was the software development centre for it. So any changes that were made, it was all done there. The development was done there, post obviously being taken on into service. So it was an interesting place. It was full of techies, computer geeks, and bearing in mind this was, when was this, Paul? This was the mid-80s?
Yeah. I remember the hard drive room, the computer room, was just massive and air-conditioned.
Yeah. Yeah, the bureau.
That was it, the bureau, yes.
Yeah.
So back in the days of the 80s, the administrators went on admin courses and PA courses. Now I think they're called PERS admin, or probably not even that nowadays. And we both got posted to STC. I got put in a office with probably the tallest person in the Royal Air Force, a guy who was 6'7", he was a corporal, and this young, I think he might have been a flying officer, on his first round of duties. And we just drank a lot of coffee, it was a great laugh. Did some tests, so we were fortunate enough. I got sent up to Buchan to do testing, and Anita's Head to do some testing on IUCAG, which for the day of life of me, I don't remember lots and lots about the Royal Air Force, but I still remember IUCAG stands for Improved United Kingdom Air Defence Ground Environment. It seems to be stuck in my brain.
Happy days. Yeah. One of the things I think SDC was good for, it brought a lot of trades together, whereas predominantly we would, radar operators and air defenders would be stuck all over the shop, and we'd have a small contingent of administrators and stuff like that. I think one thing that the SDC did was the eclectic mix of people you had there. I mean, I to be honest, I would probably have never have hung out with Paul had I not gone to Bentley Quarry, because we all basically we were of a certain age, weren't we? I mean, we're all mid 20s, you know, young. We had London on our doorstep. It was a great place to be for that perspective. But I think because we were all in this slightly alien environment to what we were used to, it kind of just threw us all together a little bit more. And we used to, you'd find yourself chatting to people you wouldn't normally, or trades you wouldn't normally talk to, because you were like in this little bubble in the middle of London. It was quite bizarre.
I think that's quite true. At the time, the trades just all tend to stick together because they work together. So the MT drivers would be at one part of the NAFI. The admin guys would be another part. And then the techies were at another part. But the SDC, because you all worked in the office and you all had this common purpose of producing, I think at the time it was called the 72-hour test.
Yeah.
So one of the things that we had to do, and it was a common bond throughout the whole building, was we were gearing up towards this massive test, which I think it took place after I left, after I moved on to 11 Group. But I just remember in the mess room, there was big sort of posters about how many days to go to the 72-hour test. And I have a feeling it was put off and off several times.
Mm. That was one of the big things, wasn't it? And this was, I think this was like the first big software build that they were putting onto the system. Because my actual job, when I first got there, I was I got put in this office called the PDL team, position description language. I didn't even understand what it was, but apparently it was a special to type third generation software programming language, whatever one of those is. And I was essentially... I had a one-to-one training course with Flight Lieutenant Coleman, who was an absolute legend in our trade. And I did, I think it was like 4 months of one-to-one programming instruction, as it were. And I spent, you know, because I was just a little minion learning how to use this computer language, any time I needed to do a software build or run some programming through the bureau, I'd get the 3 o'clock shift when everyone else had finished doing their important stuff for the 72-hour test. And with some, I'd get the 3 o'clock in the morning hour or 2 hours to run my stuff, and then go through all the mistakes that I'd made, I've got to be honest, it was soul destroying. But so if you can imagine, if you look at a display now, and the work I ended up doing was somebody would be sitting at Bucking somewhere and go, that sweep on that radar. And it was all digitally generated. Whereas before, on an analog sweep, it sweeps around. I mean, this was doing, it was like a clock ticking around. And they'd go, oh, it's green. I don't want green or blue. So an instruction would come down and Muggins here would be like, make that line blue. And you go, all right, go and find a bit of code that makes it green and then change it to blue. And then you run it through the test. Oh, it was awesome.
We remember leading up to the couple of detachments I had away, I had to spend a few nights down the bunker.
Yeah.
So I'd have to do the night shift, and you spend the day down or the night down the bunker. And I had no idea what I was doing. I just used to sit there with the rollerball, which is like a big mouse thing, and just moving it around and then tracking various aircraft. And it was, you know, for a young lad like me, he's 18 years old, it was great just to see what was going on. I had no idea what the scopies were up to, but it looked good.
It looked good.
Yeah.
Always looked good. Yeah, it was a unique building, the SDC, and it was because it was just software programming, software designing stuff. The scopies ran, the interesting thing was the scopies ran the bureau, didn't they? We had to they were all radar operators who ran the bureau. When you'd have thought that would have been a lot more, you know, technicians kind of domain, but it was an interesting time, a formative time, but certainly you know, I think we can both agree, Paul, we made some amazing friends. I think, you know, it was just the location where we were. The time, you know,
Bentley is a beautiful place. It's, there's no mistake in that. You've got the deer park there, and it's just the fantastic buildings. It was just a lovely place. For my first posting, I was very, very lucky.
I think one of the things that made 11 Group slightly not the norm was because, you know, we were SACs, weren't we, at the time? We were SACs corporals, And we were kind of like the lowest of the low, but you were in a building where one minute you could be walking past the senior air staff officer 11 group or the AOC, you know, and you were quite in awe of these people. Next minute you could be going in his office and, you know, telling them, giving them some information or stuff that they need. And they'd be going, oh, thanks, Corporal Reed, that's brilliant. Or you'd be going down to group captain air, telling him he needs to sort something out on 56 squadron or whatever, you know, and you were kind of like really in this surreal world where you were the lowest of the low, you know, in the rank structure hierarchy, but you were advising and talking, you know, to the senior people in the group, you know, and it was an amazing place to be. It really was. I mean, it just, you could send, it was, and like I said, you had the air staff registry where everybody went to. So the AOC would pop down to the air staff registry and, yeah, you know, get files from Paul, or he'd send one of his adjutants down, or group captain.
Do you remember? I was there at the time when they were organising the flight past, the 50th anniversary of the Battle of Britain flight past, and Air Vice Marshal Palin was leading it. I think he might have been in the first Spitfire to go over Buckingham Palace. Yeah. And, God, there was such a buzz. I mean, that was so well organised. I think
that was Dave Rimm, Wing Commander Dave Rimm, who put that together. That's from that picture I gave you before, Alex, of me down in the bunker. That it was Dave Rimm. He got put in charge of putting all that together. He was a great Dave Rimm, what a great bloke. The thing was, I think what really I think impressed me was from the higher ranks down, they were all really nice people. I mean, genuinely nice people. There were a couple of, I think, young flight lieutenants who were a little bit up themselves. But when you got the squadron leaders and the wing commanders and that, they'd seen a lot, they'd done a lot. I mean, these are especially up on the ground, on the air floor, they were all ex Lightning jockeys, Phantom jockeys. You know, they'd all seen a bit and done a lot and been, you know, when we had an air force that was spread all over the world, you know, they were quite relaxed, and you could have some really good conversations with them and fun, you know, and a bit of banter, you know, just always knowing where you stood in the grand scheme of things. But, you know, one of the things that I always remember is part of my job in the Air Defence Operations Centre was to brief the AOC on a daily basis. So essentially we had to put together, me and my team, I say me, my team did really, we had to put together all the stats and data for what state the radars were in, what state the air squadrons were in, how many aircraft we had, what was broken, what was fixable, what we could basically pop in the air if anything went wrong, you know, what we could actually, how we could fight a war. So we used to ring around all the squadrons, get all this information. Of course, they'd send it all to us and we'd go through it all, and we had these, it was, you know, really, really back in the day stuff, we had these laminated boards, and we'd go around and we put all the information on. So we'd have a ground board and an air board, and we'd have all the radar stuff on. And if it was unserviceable, it'd be in red. If it was serviceable, it'd be in green. So it was like we had this clear system of making it looking as it was. And then what we did was we took all this unfiltered information, and we take it around the corridor. So we go on the ground corridor, and the ground guys would look at it. Group captain Brown would look at this and go, "Well, radar's still working, isn't it? It's still kind of, yeah, well, we'll make that green because that'll look good for the AOC." So it was basically an exercise in turning as much red into green as possible. So when it went upstairs to the boss, he'd look at this, just see green, not see too much red, and he'd be quite happy. It took him years to realise that what we did was we'd go downstairs, photocopy it into black and white, and hand it to him. So it made no odds what colour it was in at the end of the day anyway, because all he saw was a black and white copy. But we used to have to take this information and get it checked and get it all put onto a brief, and then present this brief on paper to the AOC. So it was a unique position in our trade to be working that closely and kind of having to answer lots of questions from the guy right at the top, because you were the guy right at the bottom who'd been collating that information. So it was
we also had some liaison officers, didn't we? We had the RNLO, the Royal Navy liaison officer, and there was the American
who took me.
It was an unusual place, wasn't it?
Mm. that was the other thing was that made Bentley unique was the was obviously the mess itself, the Priory, the mess itself, and the events that went on there. I mean, you had the Battle of Britain ball every year, you had the Battle of Britain meal, and it's only now when when I think back on it that. Yeah, coming through the gate when you were on guard, or and I did guard a few times when the Battle of Britain was on, not the Battle of Britain, but obviously the Battle of Britain meal. And that, so you realise that a lot of the people coming through the gate were Spitfire pilots who'd actually flown in the Battle of Britain. And the young lad, this goes over your head. You don't realise the history that's passing by you as you go, as they come in and out of the place. But that used to be a real feature of the year when you'd get the roar of a Merlin over the Priory, and then they used to come down and buzz the patch as well. So down in Stanmore, you and nothing brought the spotters out than the sound of a Merlin screaming over Stanmore and doing some barrel rolls. It was a brilliant place. There's just so much going on.
Spitfire is one of the reasons why I joined the Air Force.
You got a thing about Spitfires, haven't you?
I mean, My first marriage, Jim came to my wedding, and I actually organised a Spitfire. I didn't have a wedding car. I had a Spitfire for the day, and that was fantastic. But yeah, I grew up in the shadow of the Supermarine factory in Southampton, where it was created, and so I've always had a love for the Spitfires, and yeah, that's I think that's why I joined up.
Great, I was wondering, because obviously. Working on this project at the moment, trying to sort of share the history of the bunker.
Yeah.
Of course, it's been filled in now, so I can't ever experience what you have there. But what was the bunker layout like? And did you have it? Both of you have access to all of it, or how was it sort of? How was it?
Go on, Jim. You spent more time down than
I. I was going to say, I the only place I never really had access to, only because they were it was quite a sensitive area, would have been the Uniter room, but apart from that I pretty much had access to the whole place. When we first moved down there from 11 group, we basically had our ops room area with the incel and everything like that. So we were on the, obviously you went downstairs to what would be the first floor, and then you had the lower floor. So we were on the top floor, you had the ops room. You'd go down the corridor, you had the ops room. You'd then have the our area where we worked, which was basically our little ops room with the incel off that. There was a couple of rooms with universal consoles, the IU CAD consoles in. And then we went downstairs. It was all the techies domain, so it was a lot of the hardware, the industrial kit that keeps a bunker alive and breathing, really, which is pretty much what it needs to be. But the techies, there was a small group contingent of techies down there who I used to remember one of the chiefs, can't remember his name now, but he used to walk around with his white coat on. He was like, really loved having his white coat. But they ran the show down there. We had some comms techs who worked in the Uniter room, which was basically the secure comms area. So they were pretty much locked down all the time. They wouldn't let anyone in. Comms send guys would let you in occasionally if you were nice to them. I think it was one of those buildings. It was just again, it was a unique thing. If you didn't know it was there, you wouldn't think to go looking. But it is essentially a pretty standard layout to a lot of the bunkers that you'd find elsewhere. All slightly anomalies. And I remember when we went to KOC 9 status, Combined Air Operations Centre 9, which was basically the UK's multinational command and control centre. We had to rip it all out and rip stuff out. And it was one Sunday, I think. I remember it distinctly because it was the Brazilian Grand Prix, and I wanted to get home in time. Me and Wing Commander Aspen were ripping up carpet so the carpet layers could come in the day after to lay the new carpet. The whole place got refurbed. We went up to, me and Wing Commander Aspen went up to Cardington, which again, you'd have loved it, Paul, because they were part of Douglas Bader's Spitfire.
Oh,
in storage at Cardington. Yeah, it was the overflow for the Air Force Museum. And he wanted to get some bits and bobs. It was like we were furnishing the bunker. It was hilarious. So we went up with this minibus and we came back with a propeller, like this massive single blade propeller, which was off an early hurricane or something. There were some bits from radars. There was this, and I had to dress the bunker. So as you came up the stairs, you came down the stairs and then you went up the stairs to get onto the first floor. As you came up the stairs, on the wall facing as you going down the stairs was this big propeller that we'd had mounted there, and I'd signed for that. Okay, and I left. I God knows what happened to it, but somewhere somebody's got my signature on a piece of paper saying I own a propeller. I really hope they don't come and ask me where it is because I have no idea. But we had to get all this other stuff, and I found these plans, the original plans of the bunker itself. They're like the paper plans, and to this day I'm still convinced there was a secret room off the top corridor that went into another area. I could see it on the paperwork, but I used to walk along tapping the wall, seeing if I could see where this secret entrance was. I was convinced.
I think it's true you say the layout was fairly similar. I mean, I did part in Bucking when I went up there to do the test, and it felt like I could have been in Bentley. And the same with Nita said, I think the only bunker that felt any different was the Joint Operations Centre.
But our bunkers, the standard air defence bunks, were quite a straightforward layout. You literally had a top floor and a ground floor. So a place like Bucking and Nita said, Bournemouth, you had upper ops and lower ops. You had the engineering wing and stuff like that. So it was quite a standard layout. But I think Bentley was smaller than your normal bunker purely because of the because of where it was and the real estate they had. But it was again it's one of these places you'd go downstairs, the first thing you came to would be the blast doors for the chemical environment, and you could go through the NBC area, the dirty area and clean area, and come out the other side of the blast doors, and then next thing you'd hit was the canteen, which was a fully equipped, I never saw it used, all right, but it was a fully equipped kitchen. It was everything industrial kitchen set up that was there. And I can remember there was a telly in there as well. We used to go up and watch the Formula One qualifying on a Friday at lunchtime and stuff like that, just to get a few hours to go and watch that in there. And then you go down the stairs. And then when you got down the stairs, you could literally go back up the stairs onto the top floor or carry along the engineering corridor. And downstairs was all engineering. And you go around there and then you could go out the back up through the rear blast doors up out the ventilation shafts. Or you go along the top corridor where you had all the operation stuff. But it was one of those things. What I really loved about it was once you went in there, nobody had a clue what you were doing, and I'll admit it now, I was the risk champion of 1992, I think, for quite a while, because once we'd done our job, which was essentially briefing the AOC, we just had to keep ourselves entertained and occupied. So we do a bit of training, we do a bit of int work, and then once we'd done all that, we'd break out the risk board and play risk, and then go for a cup of tea down in the crew room, or just go and see people, go for a walk up to 11 group, see how they're getting on, see if there's anything they want doing. It was a great time.
And on the night times I spent down there, I read a lot of books. I spent about an hour just playing with a rollerball. And then when that was done, I'd go off and read a book and sit in the crew room, have a cup of tea or coffee.
Yeah.
And it was a nice and relaxed time, shall we say.
It was really, really, like I said, like we both said, it just, you're young lads and lasses, your first proper job really, you're on the outskirts of London, and like I said, there were some great people, and everybody knew everybody because it was so small. I met my wife, she was a supplier, because everyone mixed in the junior ranks mess and in the NAFI and in the families club, you just had this kind of bond that you were all working together.
Right, yeah. It's interesting because obviously you make it sound like your work there was quite relaxed and it wasn't too pressured. But obviously, the role of the bunker, was quite serious. So like how do you think that, like, what was the purpose of the bunker? Like, had there been an attack coming in, how would your walls have changed? You know, how would things have changed from that sort of more relaxed sort of everyday work to, you know, going into an exercise or, you know, into an operation?
What would the key thing I think to remember is that the most important word in standby a defense operation center is the word standby. Okay, because you've got a primary air defense operations center over at High Wycombe, which is where it's all at. Okay, and we literally were the standby. So we were activated at times. I think there was once there was something going on over Wycombe. There was a storm. The weather was really bad, and the bunker started to flood. So they activated us. And it's essentially it's like anything. Had we been activated, and when we were activated for exercises, I'm sure Paul will back this up, but his department would move down to the registry in the bunker, and he would run the air staff registry from the bunker. So it'd be from a hardened facility. So everything that was in a soft facility would move down. So if you can imagine where we operated, we had all these positions already set up. So all these desks, phones, teleprinters. Everything was set up. We had a registry that was set up, okay, with basically all the comms and everything in it. And had we been activated, then, you know, we'd have had the Renlo. He'd have a position. We'd have the guy doing, he was the tanking, tasking man. We'd have the guys would come down. So when we did have exercises, we did run exercises where we would man the bunker with people. But it really was on a day-to-day basis, just ticking over, doing whatever jobs came in on a day-to-day basis, and basically trying to mirror what was happening at strike at Wycombe, but I suppose without the stress, really. Can't lie,
people in High Wycombe did more work than we did, that's for sure.
Yeah. But someone had to do it.
Got it. Also, I wanted to ask you, obviously there was a lot of visitors to Bentley Priory being, you know, the place it was. And I remember, Jim, before you mentioning there being a visit from someone from the Russian Air Force.
Yeah.
Is that correct? Yeah. Would you like to talk about that a bit more?
I can't remember his name now. I sent you the picture, didn't I? We basically, I think it was a big partnership for peace. There was a big sort of like cultural exchange going on, and we had a visit to the bunker from this Russian Air Force colonel, I think he was. And again, I think I mentioned at the time, I always remember there was this big photo opportunity with Bob Hodgkinson, warrant officer in charge of the bunker. He was being introduced by the AOC to this Russian general from the Air Force, and the look on his face was just like absolute, was an absolute picture. He was just so annoyed that we were allowing this Russian into his bunker, and it was just like, it just went against every fiber in his being to allow this to happen. But he was very respectful, very, very, you know, again, it was a little lesson. You learn these lessons observing Bob. He was very gracious, and he you know, but you could tell underneath it he wasn't happy. I think I had to make him about three cups of tea to calm him down afterwards.
They used to fly in by helicopter, didn't they? And land at the other side of the...
He used to land on the football pitch, didn't they?
Yeah, that was it.
Yeah.
I think one year we had an American military helicopter land, but I can't for the life of me remember who was on it. And we had a few dignitaries turn up.
Yeah. Because Bentley was pretty much the only place you could land a helicopter. So we had the AOC would fly in and out when he was required to go places. But occasionally you'd have the old private person come in to land on, just so they could save themselves some fees and a trip from London Airport or something, which was always quite interesting. But there's loads of stuff used to just happen there. And the Priory itself, I mean, if you ever get to go into the Priory, I mean, back in the day, it really was it was the officer's mess. You had the Priory bit, but it was a living, breathing officer's mess and everything that went on there. And even their accommodation around the back, the blocks at the back, I don't know if they've probably been knocked down now, I think, but they weren't the best accommodation in the world, even for commissioned officers. But I think it was just the fact that you were there kind of made up for that sort of thing. But yeah, it was good.
Amazing. That's great. Thank you. So yeah, it's been a pleasure having you talk about your experiences at RAF Bentley Priory. And I'm sure, the listeners are going to love hearing your tales and your stories about your experiences there.
Happy days. Brilliant. No, thank you very much, Alex. It's always good. All right.
All right. Yep. Take care. All right. See you then. Bye.
All right. Take care, mate. See you later, Paul.
Bye.